versus Aleman Lozano, appellate number 25-3012.
May it please the court, Craig Kozlarich on behalf of the appellant Diego Aleman Lozano. If I may please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
Your Honors, earlier this month, the Supreme Court in Hamani stated that affording the government broad power to designate any group as dangerous and thereby disqualify its members from having a gun would risk allowing it to quickly swallow the Second Amendment. Then on Thursday, the Supreme Court in Wolford forcefully rejected argument that a sovereign, in that case, the state of Hawaii, may premise its firearm restriction on discriminatory laws of the past, such as the post-emancipation Black Codes. Such laws were rejected as tainted artifacts intended to subjugate newly freed blacks and not relevantly similar for failing the why portion of Bruin Part 2.
Do we need to rely on any of those to address this case when there are laws that talk about
citizens? And
thank
immigrants.
You. Yep. Citizens, those who have allegiances to other sovereigns. Well, isn't this different than the Black Code cases?
The government bears the burden here of showing a relevant historic analog, and they have briefed extensively that laws dating back to the 18th or 17th century barring Catholics, Native Americans, and other disfavored groups. Those are cited by the government.
If we put aside the disfavored groups and we look at the English Bill of Rights, which only allowed those who were subjects of the king to have firearms, the American colonists who disarmed anyone who was still loyal to England, and then the U.S. states when they became states, and they had bans on those who were not aligned with and did not support the new country. So do we have to get into any of those other categories that you just mentioned in order to look for analogs?
I think it's unavoidable here, both due to the proposal by the government as well as the finding in Hamani, the litigant there being a dual citizen of both Pakistan and the United States. That was in no way viewed as an impediment to his right to possess under the Second Amendment.
But he was a citizen of the United States.
Correct, yes, a dual citizen.
And if you look at the language in McDonald, Bruin, Rahimi, where they talk about it, the Second Amendment applying to citizens, Hamani says it belongs to all Americans, Wolford said the people are those who are, quote, members of the political community. Don't all those point to the idea that the individual has to have allegiance to the sovereign?
That gets us into the panel's first question of the focus order regarding the conflicting language in Hamani versus Wolford. Hamani does state that all Americans have the right to bear arms. This is, of course, in conflict with Wolford's finding that all members of the political community are protected by the Second Amendment. We submit
the question arises, what does political community mean? Could be the same thing expressed differently, or it may be something different, which is another reason as to why it makes sense to just assume the first prong of Bruin and move on to the second.
The district court did assume the first prong and ultimately denied on the second prong. But to answer your question, the definition in Wolford of all members of the political community is consistent with Heller's definition that the people, for purposes of the Second Amendment, is the class of persons who are part of the national community or who have otherwise developed sufficient connection with this country to be considered part of that community.
You think those are interchangeable? They're equals?
Not that they're equals, no. That the expression in Wolford of all members of the political community is rooted in precedent going back to the modern Second Amendment Genesis case being Heller, which Heller approvingly cites the prior Supreme Court case of Verdugo Ortiz, which interpreted the people for purposes of the Fourth Amendment to be broader than citizen but narrower than all persons, finding that once an alien lawfully enters and resides in this country, becomes invested with the rights guaranteed by the Constitution to all people within our borders. Now, the Tenth Circuit...
He still can't vote.
That is correct, yes.
He can't hold lots of public offices.
That is true. It is not all of the rights, but that is what was stated by the Supreme Court in Verdugo Ortiz, which the Tenth Circuit in Huitron Guizar saw no principled way to exclude non-citizens from the Second Amendment, but not exclude them from the Fourth Amendment when it's the same language, the first, the people, and both of these rights originate from the Bill of Rights from the founding generation and concern the sanctity and security of home against intrusion.
But all that just suggests to me that it is such a can of worms, and then you've got, in addition to that, the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, and we don't have to get into it. Even if we get into it, we still have to go on to prong two. Let's just go to prong two and forget about this metaphysics that we have to engage in under the first prong, which is one could analogize, at least in this context, to arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Well, turning to the panel.
Depends on the volume of the pin, the mass of the angels, the kind of dance they're doing. Question can't be answered.
That brings us to the court's focus order, question two, the effect of Wolford's treatment of the black codes. Now, the government bears the burden here of showing a relevantly similar historic analog. This is a difficult burden. The government can cite nothing more than the appellant's foreign citizenship or the foreign citizenship of visa holders as a group to suggest danger or disloyalty. Now, federal law did not restrict the possession rights of non-citizens until 1998, of all non-citizens, including those legally in the country pursuant to visa or other legal status. Now, during the founding era, non-citizens or immigrants were not routinely or blanketly prohibited from possession, since many people at the time were, in fact, foreign-born. The
Tenth Circuit. What about restricting it to landowners? Were the statutes that restricted gun ownership to landowners?
There were, yes.
Again, and why are we wading into those waters? It makes no sense.
Because Bruin forces us to wade into the waters of history.
Only if we say that to resolve this, we have to deal with the first step of Bruin. And Bruin, they clearly did because they were laying down the test. But we're past that now. And rather than trying to trudge up all the metaphysics that you're asking us to make sense of, why not just go on to the second step?
Well, I'm speaking to the second step.
You may still win there.
I believe I'm speaking to the second step of a historic analog.
Okay.
Now, the Tenth Circuit, again, in Huitron Gizar, made findings that the founder's notion of citizenship involved little more than a period of residency and being a male with some capital. You had also referenced the requirement of land ownership.
But that goes back to Judge McKee's point, is that goes to, one could say, is who are the people for step one purposes. And I think what the suggestion is, let's talk about the purported analogs.
Yes.
So I'm not sure how that's an analog. That's a fact of history that you're sharing with us, yes?
Well, it is an analog in the sense that if all that was required to be considered a citizen at the time was a period of residency, being a male with some capital, that is much more black and white than our current immigration system, where there is unknown alien and full citizen and various shades of gray in between that did not exist at time of the founding generation. Now, Bruin does not find that that is dispositive, but ultimately we must apply historic principle by analogy, need not be a dead ringer. To the current practice and the current regulation. And the fact that now we have this broad law prohibiting possession by authorized non-citizens whose presence in the United States is known, accepted, and approved following vetting by the federal government itself, that is distinguishable.
Now, I know this is a facial challenge, but can you tell us what kind of visa your client had?
The record states that he has a non-immigrant work visa.
That's all I could see too. So nothing, there's nothing else to share with us from the record.
Correct.
Other than and what is the duration of that non-immigrant work visa? Is there anything in the record that would tell us that? Or is there something in the law that would tell us a non-immigrant work visa lasts for a period of time?
I am not recalling anything in the record regarding the duration of that. That did permit lawful employment. He paid payroll taxes, but ultimately this is a facial challenge. So,
right. So it doesn't matter whether he's a H-1B-1 visa holder, a T visa holder, a vacation holder, doesn't matter.
Correct. It is our position that the approval of the visa following vetting brings the group of immigrant, non-immigrant visa holders within the Second Amendment due to that approval for resident lawful residency by the federal government.
So is your position there is no analog in the history that would support this restriction?
That is our position, yes. The government has not met its burden in that respect.
How do you get around those authorities that have been brought to our attention through the government, or through the case law that seems to address a companion statute, that say the concern at the founding was allegiance to the sovereign, whether it was before the United States existed, at the time of the revolution, and immediately after the founding, all saying we are going to restrict those who have allegiances to another sovereign from possessing a firearm. Why are they not analogous?
The district court did focus on the lack of a loyalty oath. There's nothing in record to indicate that a loyalty oath to the United States is required in order to obtain a visa, but we can infer from the issuance of the visa that vetting was completed successfully, and the person cooperated with that administrative process.
But that's not a loyalty oath.
Right, that's a very different thing.
Yes, my point is that with or without an oath, the non-immigrant visa holders are subject to the laws of the United States, the obligation to pay taxes. This particular visa holder was issued a...
Who's here illegally is also subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
Yes, but without the permission of the United States. And we submit that that's where the line ought to be drawn here. Nothing in our proposal would authorize undocumented persons to have Second Amendment rights. That is a bit of an outlier in the circuit court decisions, which are admittedly quite in conflict with each other. That is a bit of an outlier, I believe, from the Seventh Circuit.
Back to this first issue, if we address it, what holding do you think we should make? Do you think we should make the holding, or do you propose, should we say that a visa holder, any visa holder, regardless of the type of visa, is a, quote, member of the political community such that they are a person and have Second Amendment rights?
Well, that would be consistent with Verdugo or Quiles, which interpreted the phrase the people for purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
Would that be consistent, though, that they're part of the national community or have substantial connection to the country if the visa holder is here for a student visa? There are a more narrow period of time. I'm not sure how you can, if that's the test you're proposing to Judge Phipps, that the person is part of the national community, how is someone, if we have to look at any way this statute could be enforced, a visa holder who's here on a visitor's visa?
Well, as was found by the Tenth Circuit in comparing the Fourth Amendment and the Second Amendment, it was found that all persons with legal presence in the United States are protected
by
the Fourth
Amendment. I guess what I'm saying is this, is my thought, is Judge McKee says that this, that the first issue is angels dancing on the head of a pin, and it may be, if we want to write broadly on that. But if we get to pick off, since you want to bring a facial challenge, you have to negative every possible consequence of that. And so if there would be one type of visa out there, student visa or something else like that, where a person would not be part of the political community just by virtue of having the visa, wouldn't that be a basis on which your claims, a facial challenge would fail?
I see my time is up, if I may answer. Well, there certainly are different types of visas. Ultimately, the common thread between them is legal presence approved by the federal government. So we would submit that that is the standard.
But so legal presence approved by the federal government, you would have us equate to membership in a political community?
It is accepted presence in our country, and it is the opportunity to build a life as a lawful person within our nation.
Okay, any other questions? Judge Phipps, any thanks? All right, we'll have you back on rebuttal. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Patrick Bannon on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin just by clarifying a little bit about the historical analogs that we cited to, and that were addressed by a number of courts that we addressed in our opinion as well. And I think, Judge Schwartz, to your point about before we get into any of the discriminatory laws and the Black Codes argument, I think there are the historical analogs that we point to, which do concern allegiance. And I think those are the important historical analogs that we address for step two. And I think, starting initially with the English Bill of Rights, which the court in Heller, very clearly identified as the precursor to the Second Amendment, and the distinction made in the English Bill of Rights between, subjects and aliens, and the right to bear arms applying to specifically subjects. And as the Seventh Circuit identified in Carbajal Flores and Jimenez Chillon for the 11th Circuit and some of these other circuit court decisions, that understanding came over to the United States in the early colonies, and I think even Heller put to as the best example of the scope of the Second Amendment, the early constitutional provisions from the states. So I think, those as important historical analogs are what we discuss in our brief, and what other courts have found significant in the context of challenge it to Section 922 G5A specifically, but you know the same principle applies here in terms of Section 922 G5B. So I think just to clarify a little bit.
You know, that's interesting to me because we treat these issues as Bruin Step 1 and Bruin Step 2, and you know, judge-made test made by Supreme Court. But when we begin to ask the question of who can own a gun or who has the right to bear arms, there's a little blurring because who could be an individual, and we can look to individual laws, but who also matters in terms of are you part of the people? And so I don't know that they're, you know, we're supposed to pretend that they can be completely disentangled, but who are you, a member of the people, and then who was regulated? We're asking kind of the same question. So when we talk about the English Bill of Rights, and we begin to say subjects had the right to bear arms, but aliens did not, should that also bear on any of our interpretation of who the people is, at least with respect to the right to bear arms?
I think you're right, Judge Phipps, and I agree that the steps one and two aren't completely separate in terms of the analysis, and I think the historical, you know, tradition of firearm regulation is relevant to both steps. And I think, you know, specifically looking at how, you know, the Supreme Court from Heller through Wolford, the use of the term, you know, citizens and describing the Second Amendment as citizens' rights, you know, is a relevant consideration, both, you know, Bruin Step 1 and Bruin Step 2. But I think specifically for Bruin Step 1, you know, the precursor, which has been identified, you know, throughout these opinions being the English Bill of Rights, you know, does make a clear distinction between subjects and aliens. And I think that that distinction, you know, in terms of who the people are, carries over, you know, ratification and even post-ratification
here.
But then
what do we do about the same words in the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment where the Supreme Court has said that does apply to others? It's not limited to citizens. Like, aren't we risking a big conflict within the same two words throughout the Constitution if we grant your view that for Second Amendment purposes, it's citizens, but for those other amendments with the same words, it's broader?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it is a very difficult question. I think Judge Thapar and his concurrence in the Escobar-Tamal case, I think, you know, walked through the definition through the First and the Fourth and the Second Amendment in terms of the people, but even in doing so, acknowledged that it's really a complicated issue. And I think Judge McKee, to your point earlier, constitutional avoidance, following the filing of the briefs here, the First Circuit also assumed without deciding that the first step of Bruin 1, and did so specifically because of constitutional avoidance, recognizing that this would be, you know, a very difficult question with out of implications.
Your briefing makes vigorous arguments that citizens are who's covered by the Second Amendment, Bruin Step 1. Is it your position now, having seen the First Circuit opinion, that it may be best for a court to, for the purpose of this, assume without deciding that a non-immigrant visa holder would be among the people, and then see on, and then proceed to step two?
Well, I think you know, nothing in Wolford or the Vizcaino Piguero.
Say yes.
You know, that was going to be my ultimate answer. Yes, Judge McKee. I think that is the case that you know, even the arguments that we presented in our briefing being what they are, that it'd be perfectly appropriate for court to.
But, I mean, at one level, though, doesn't Wolford make Bruin Step 2 a little harder for you? I mean, doesn't it say that when we're looking for historical analogs, we're not looking at the tainted ones anymore? And so people usually come and they talk about, you know, black codes, Catholics disarming Protestants, Protestants disarming Catholics. I don't know, you know, query whether those are tainted enough. But once we take those out, you know, that shrinks the pool of Bruin Step 2 by a lot. At least if we want to go chronology, it goes by a lot. You have the English Bill of Rights, and then, correct me if I'm misreading the cases in your understanding, we have the English Bill of Rights, then we have a colossal dead zone until like the 20th century when we begin to get analogs that talk about property ownership or immigration status as a basis of regulating. Am I missing something in that? In the dead zone of kind of things that we could use for analogs,
No,
chronologically?
And just to push back a little bit on the Wolford analysis with the Black Code specifically, you know, I think, first of all, you know, there are here the English Bill of Rights, which is, you know, an allegiance-based distinction between subjects and aliens. But I think you have, you know, in the Wolford decision, I think the court was really concerned with, in that context, the why of the Bruin test really didn't line up, because you had a discriminatory purpose where in the Black Hoes laws, where in Hawaii's argument, they were really trying to use it for a different purpose, whereas with the laws restricting those who haven't sworn allegiance, I think the why does add up, and I think the circuits that have addressed that question have addressed that pretty squarely. That the laws that we cited to were really based on allegiance. And I think,
can we talk about the allegiance to the sovereign, usually reflected by a loyalty oath? Since we're on the eve of the 250th birthday of our beautiful country, the Marquis de Lafayette comes to the United States bearing arms.
At the age of 18.
Well,
allegiance remained with France, although he certainly helped the United States cause. How do we reconcile that bit of history?
Well, I think, we cite to 922G has a companion piece to that does have exceptions to 922G5B for specifically foreign officials, law enforcement officers, which I think to your hypothetical
is consistent.
But he
would have been in 922Y. He would come in under 922Y. He would have gotten a waiver from the AG. But he was in. Is that the argument?
I mean, I think so, based
on... By the way, he's a citizen now. Okay. Honors, he's a citizen now.
This shows the brilliance, the insight of the history and tradition analysis.
I have a different question, though, for you. As the Supreme Court has said, the Second Amendment right is to protect the right of self-defense. And if that's the purpose of the right, why should someone who's here with permission from the United States have less of a right to self-defense than a citizen would have?
Indeed, they need more of a right to self-defense.
Well, I think, going back to, the historical analogs and, the demonstration of allegiance, that there is a concern with, trustworthiness with allegiance, that was the case, the time of the founding and ratification and, continues to be the case.
That dodges the question. She's asking specifically about the fundamental right of self-defense, which seems to be endemic the way the Second Amendment is interpreted now.
Well, I think the court was clear in those decisions, but also referred to law-abiding citizens' right of self-defense. And, I know that this court has addressed the law-abiding language from that decision, but I think, the citizens' language was used deliberately. And I think this court, post-Bruin in Range 2 and in Lara addressed that, looking at how Heller defines the right, and specifically to the language that the court used as all Americans, American citizens, citizens' right. So I think, not characterizing the self-defense piece of the holding, there is this other language that the court uses and consistently uses to define the Second Amendment right.
If the right is self-defense, and that's what the Second Amendment's purpose is, shouldn't every person have that right?
Well, I think looking back to the history and tradition of the Second Amendment, that there was, even in the precursor to the Second Amendment, this distinction between subjects and aliens, and understanding that was the same concern there, that was self-defense, but...
But I guess, as I think of the history, and maybe I just need to except kind of the self-defense rationale is it's the through line through a lot of Supreme Court Second Amendment decisions, but we also tie it, although it's an individual right, it comes in the context of militia, which is a little bit more national defense. And so if there's any national defense component to the right to bear arms, that would, I guess, maybe I'm making the argument for you, but trace out that allegiance matters if the Second Amendment has national defense purposes as well.
But a second... Hasn't the Supreme Court kind of read militia out of the Second Amendment? I mean, that's what it says, but that's clearly not what it means.
Well, I think, sort of related to national defense, but more in line with, the allegiance and that concern, I think, the concern with an allegiance to the sovereign, I think, is, a national concern. Whether or not it's militia-based, I think, that is a through line that definitely goes through, the historical tradition. And I think that that's something that's been acknowledged by, you know, the courts addressing this this exact issue. You know, I think, the Seventh Circuit in Carvajal Flores said, you know, in discussing how, you know, the relief from this being, you know, the swearing of an allegiance or today naturalization takes one out of this the scope of this provision, that, you know, the same relief pledging allegiance exists today that has existed throughout history. So I think that, you know, is, you know, the same sort of through line.
You talk about allegiance being what the precursor laws teach us, that allegiance is what gives you the right. But Congress created a statute with an exception we just mentioned, 922Y, which allows non-immigrant individuals to come to the United States to hunt. They don't have any allegiance, but they get to come. So how do we square that?
Well, I think the important concern is that, you know, that the 22G5B itself is consistent with historical tradition. It doesn't mandate that that law has to be in effect necessarily.
You're just saying that, if I can make sure I'm understanding, you're saying there's no, from your point of view, there's no constitutional right to bear arms if you don't fall into one of these categories. However, you can have the privilege that Congress might give you. Is that the idea that you're conveying? Or am I misunderstanding?
No, I think that that's the purpose of the 922GY, I think, is, you know, recognizing, you know, certain instances where that might be the case, you know, based on, you know, the license or whatever the United States provide, that there's no mandate necessarily that every non-citizen, you know, must be disarmed if they determine that these maybe this trustworthy, you know, demonstrations of allegiance aren't as much of an issue. But, you know, with respect to the historical tradition of firearm regulation, that 922G5B is consistent with that historical tradition.
What's the purpose of that subsection B? Congress had A in mind, then B comes along. What's your understanding of the purpose of B?
Well, I think, you know, it's consistent with the understanding that, you know, people that fall into the non-immigrant visa holder category, it's also, you know, a temporary non-immigrant status, that it's, you know, someone who, again, is not sworn allegiance, is not undergoing the naturalization process they're here for. And we don't have, you know, the full scope in the record of Mr. Alvin Lozano specifically, but he's raising a facial challenge, that there's a number of different provisions that qualify under that section. They may be very short in duration. They, you know, may relate to study or work or other things. But I think the concern was that the demonstration of allegiance concerns was the same, you know, in that context.
And in terms of the analogs you're relying on, putting aside the black codes or other facially discriminatory ones, am I understanding you to say the English Bill of Rights, the at the time of the colonists were prohibiting those called the Loyalists, and then the early state constitutions that restricted who could have a firearm based upon whether they supported the new country. Am I right?
Yes, sir. My time is up. Can I answer
that question? Yeah,
yes.
Great.
Yes, but I don't think our argument would be that we would put aside those other laws. If the court were to consider that that would be appropriate, I think those other historic analogs are good to consider. But, you know, our position is that those even following welfare, that those should be considered as historical analogs, because I think the why here is different than the court was addressing in Wolfer. And I think, you know, the site specifically to the Seventh Circuit said that these discriminatory laws would unquestionably fail to overcome constitutional scrutiny today. They nevertheless illuminate a historical through line of disarming people based on their allegiances or lack thereof. So I think that's addressing the why of why these laws should be considered, which I think is a little different than the Wolfer context.
Understood. Judge McKee, have any other questions?
Maybe just one on your definition of people is limited to kind of only citizens. Do you think that the canon of consistent usage applies, so that in the First Amendment context, only citizens have the right to peacefully assemble, and in the Fourth Amendment's only citizens have the right to be secure in their homes against unreasonable searches and seizures?
Well, I think we addressed the term in terms of the Second Amendment history.
I'm just curious about the canon of consistent usage, though.
But I think the canon of consistent usage would have to apply, you know, the term the people, I think was used specifically, but I think if you look at state, the state analogs to the Second Amendment that Heller cites to as sort of the best examples of the scope of the amendment, and I think it's in footnote 8 of Heller where they're quoted, the term the people and citizens are used in, you know, in these provisions, and they're not distinguished between by the court in Heller, where citizen and people are used, by citizens used by some states, the people is used by other states, and the court cites them for the same reason. So I think, you know, that's a good historical example of the scope that Heller cites to, in and we address in our briefing as well.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to return to Judge Schwartz's question about the practices of the founding era. As we celebrate the semi-quincentennial this week and think back to the founding, it has been noted that of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, 8 were born outside of the American colonies. Now, I bring this up because Bruin instructs us to look to history to define the scope of the pre-existing right as is enshrined by the Second Amendment. Now, I think it's fair to infer that the founders would not then disarm those 8 signers of the Declaration of Independence a mere 15 years after the Declaration of Independence when the Bill of Rights was implemented. I'd next like to address Judge Phipp's question regarding Wolfer. Does that increase the burden on the government? We submit that it does. That it does make the burden on the government harder. The tension in that case was between the majority, which found, we cannot consider the black codes at all. This is anathema to our present laws. We will not give consideration to this. But the dissent says, well, hang on a second. History is history, warts and all. History is our history. And if we can divorce those laws from the discrimination, which of course now we would recognize as an equal protection or due process violation, but the underlying Second Amendment question, we cannot throw out the baby with the bathwater.
But isn't part of the reason why that the in Walford the black codes were rejected as an analog was because the overall purpose of those codes was to just hold down from gaining anything in society in every way for a particular class of people, and didn't go to firearms possession per se. It captured it, but it didn't go. Wasn't that part of the motivation for why they felt the black codes were
inapt? It was, and of course the concurrence is a third position, but 922 G5B does just that. It targets a specific class of individual, which Hamani strongly warned against. Finally, we submit that the government's position here that the Second Amendment definition of the people is limited to citizens alone, that is completely inconsistent with case law, perhaps not at the Supreme Court level, but there are at least 5 circuits cited in our brief which found that the people, for purposes of the Second Amendment, includes some non-citizens, not necessarily all, not necessarily undocumented, but those who are here legally are included to some degree by at least 5 circuits courts. So the government's position here is we would submit
but
a bit of an outlier.
For you to win, wouldn't every visa holder have to be part of the people?
As a facial challenge, yes.
Okay.
Unless there are any other questions.
Well, thank you. Okay, we're good, thank you.
We ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, always an honor.
Nice to see you both. Thank you very much for your arguments and your briefing was incredibly helpful, and for being prepared on short notice to address that, which came to all of us on pretty short notice. So we really appreciate you responding to our inquiry. The court will take the matter under advisement.